Well, good morning. Good to see everybody. We're glad for those that are visiting with us. Imagine setting off from Egypt with whatever you can carry on your person, on the pack animals that you might have, the carts. You must take tents, obviously food. At this point, the manna has not yet come. Cooking utensils, water, hay for the animals. Have you ever thought about all the things they would have had to cart out at first? Because they're not certain what God is going to do, but they have to provide for them and their houses. Now you are 45 days into the wilderness. You and your family are running seriously short of food. Water has already been a problem that would have been chapters before this, but God had provided. There are at least 2 million Israelites, most likely much more than that, 3 or 4 million, who are trudging along following the glory cloud of Yahweh to only God knows where. Fear takes hold. You wonder if this God can feed all of these people. Panic turns to grumbling out loud. First to your family, maybe your friends, then finally to Moses and Aaron. And just then Yahweh appears in all his glory in the cloud and speaks to Moses, telling them that he will rain bread from heaven upon the Israelites. Bread from heaven in the middle of a desert? And what could it be? You and I might think of loaves falling down if we were thinking of bread. Rolls, something of that kind, they would have thought in terms of flat bread. But what were they thinking? And there it is the next morning. And the dew lifts from the ground as it does if you've been out in the desert. There it is, white flakes, small as coriander seed. You can think about something very, very tiny. And then because there's so much of it, it's like looking in the winter at frost that's on the field. And it's all over the place. Can you imagine how far out it extended from the edges of the camp? Because here's the deal. They're going to go out every morning and gather 2 omers for themselves. And an omer was about 2 quarts, or 2 liters, your version may say, at the bottom. Some will gather more, some will gather less, because others are going to gather in front of you, and you may have not got the start, or you're older, and it takes longer. You think about all the things that had to go on. Yet God says you can take it, and you can boil it, or you can bake it, but it is bread to eat. And man, it must have tasted good because the scripture says it tasted my favorite food like honey, honey on wafers. And that will go on every day except for Sabbath, every day for 40 years. They will get up and gather manna and feed their families. Well, the text says to us, if we drop down from what Greg read to us at verse 13, that he fulfilled what he said, that they're going to eat meat. This is one of the occasions where he brought quail to the camp, but we're not told mostly about that. Sort of a side note. It's the manna that takes front center in this chapter. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. When the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost, on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "Man hu." Now that's the Hebrew. We get it as manna. But what it really says is, look at what it says. What is it? They were asking a question. They look at it. They don't know what to do except to find out from the commands of God what to do with it. And they have no idea. They just simply say, "What is it?" And it's translated into our language as manna. For they did not know, it says, what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can. You shall take an omer." They got falsely said a minute ago, too, but one omer. "According to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent." The people of Israel did so, and they gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over. Whoever gathered little had no lack. I drop down to verse 22. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath of the Lord. Bake what you will bake, boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning." So they laid it aside till the morning as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath of the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you will gather it, but on the seventh, which is the Sabbath, there will be none." And on the seventh day, some of the people went out together, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my law? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it like wafers made with honey. In verse 35, the people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. We're studying along with Brother Ross about the different books of the Bible. And so as I read through, things are popping out to me. You know how it always does. So I'm going to be behind Brother Ross in lessons. There'll be things that I'll be thinking of and working on. And this is one that just kind of blared out at me. A whole chapter dedicated to manna. And really, what is manna? It is, as the opening part of my PowerPoint says, it is a test. Look at verse 4 with me again. "Behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go and gather a day's portion that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not." Now, what is the purpose of a test? A lot of y'all are done with school. I'm sure you are rejoicing. I know all the teachers are. I've been married to a former teacher a long time, and I know how they rejoice when school is finally done. It's really never done if you're a teacher. But the kids are rejoicing. But you think about having to take tests, particularly as you reach that very final part of the semester. Most of the time you've got finals, we call them, and you're having to take tough tests. What's the point of them? Well, they're to give you a measuring stick, a place that you can say, "I know this subject matter." And then if I miss the test, if I'm really bad, or if I'm just slightly so, then I know by the correction what the proper answer is. It's going to measure that. It's going to measure the proficiency of your using the knowledge. Not that it just be, and sometimes some of the tests are like this, stuff you'll never need again. But they're going to be tests of things that you will use again and again. I can imagine engineers learn a lot of things in their coursework that definitely they're going to use when they get out in the field. And when they have to apply all of that, those math equations and different things to make sure that bridge going over the Mississippi River doesn't do what it has recently done. Tests are to help us have a workable knowledge, a practical and workable knowledge of it. But I'm going to tell you, tests are not pleasant. Tests weed out people. You ever hear the phrase in our culture, did they make the grade? We use that far after the time that tests in schools take place. But what we mean by that is some people are cut. And I'm going to tell you, there's some people don't make law school. There's some people don't make med school. There's some people that don't make the engineering school. There's some people don't make electrician. You are. There's some people that aren't going to make it because they don't pass the test. And tests weed out people. It separates the chaff from the wheat, as we would say. In Matthew 13, verse 20 and 21, Jesus said, "But he that receives the seed," remember we're talking about it in terms of the word of God being sown in the hearts of people, but in the physical story, "seed that's sown in stony places. This is he that hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation and persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles." Now there's a test that the guy isn't going to make it. Because as soon as he has the hardships that come with obeying Jesus Christ in the world around us and in our own families, we just don't want that. And we just walk away from him. When Abraham was commanded to sacrifice his son Isaac, what choice did he have? Do it or don't. But if you do it, you're going to have great faith. If you don't, you fall into the millions and millions of others that will never see heaven. Tests are, as the Deuteronomy passage tells us, as he's remembering in chapter 8 and verse 2, you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And so, but after they've done it for those 40 years and on the verge of going into the lands, the book of Deuteronomy is on the plains of Moab, and he's recounting the second law, only the idea of to this new generation, telling them again the story. He reminds them that was the purpose of the manna. It was to test you. Have we been paying lip service to God? Oh, I will follow your lead, Father. The rich young ruler came, saying to Jesus, all the commandments that you're telling me to do, I've kept them from my youth up. But Jesus, loving him, looked at him and said, one thing you lack. Go sell all you have and come and follow me. And when the young man heard that, Matthew 19:22, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. And you and I have rightly said about that passage that that's not a command that's given to all of us. In fact, you go to Timothy and he tells the rich, he doesn't say sell all you have. He says those that are rich among you, let them share. But he doesn't say to all the rich later, you've got to sell everything. So we rightly say that. But we're going to miss the point. Because what if the needs of God's people were such like they were in Barnabas when he went and sold that field and other people, and they just took a pretty big hunk of maybe an income producing property and just laid it, sold it and laid the proceeds at the apostles' feet? Would you do that? Would you sell your farm? Would you sell your house? You know, we can pay lip service to what is said here to the rich young ruler, but if it was said to me, would I do that? But I liquidate all of my retirement accounts, liquidate everything that I have, sell it all, and come and follow Jesus. It's real easy to read it, isn't it? I want to do your will, O God. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? Luke chapter 6, verse 46. And so all of a sudden, one of our children divorces. And they're in a divorce in which they are a party that cannot remarry, according to Matthew 19, verse 9. Now what? I've seen people change. I have watched congregation after congregation, even been part of it, in midst of the terrible aftermath, when people will not do what God says. And then the family fights everybody else, and others join in because they're friends of that family, and all the mess that can happen in a local church, all because somebody said, I don't like what God says. Try withdrawing from a family member. You'll find out real quick what people believe. You'll find out real quick. And if you think that we're not able for those things to affect us here, then we need to think again. I only want what you want for me. Would we have listened to these words? Most assuredly, I say to you, Peter, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wish, but when you were old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you or bind you and carry you where you do not wish. This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. And when he had said this to him, he said to Peter, follow me. Peter, if you're going to follow me, then you're going to die a very unpleasant death. A death that you would not want to die. Somebody else is going to force you and take you where you do not want to go. Will you follow me? See, your life may not turn out like you thought it was going to. I can look at things in my life and I wish paths had been very different. I wish things had turned out very different in regard to junctures in my life. But that's not what happened. And I don't know if God was involved in those things, though I know he is overall involved and cares about our life. He cares for us. Cast all your cares upon him. He loves us. But our life is not always going to go like we want. Are we willing to follow him? Because tests, folks, are going to weed out people. And tests prepare people for new ground, don't they? They develop your faith. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6 and 7, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, the realness of it, is it the real deal, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise and honor and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ." Folks, every last one of us, we're going to have wildernesses in our lives. We're going to wander in the wilderness. And we may wander there for 40 years. I'm just saying to you, it may be longer than you ever expected. "Will you worship me only when I defeat your enemies?" The Amalekites came up and cut off their tail, and Joshua defeated them as Moses held up the rod of God in his hands, and Hur and Aaron helped him keep on holding him up when he grew weary. "Or will you worship me when you are cast into Babylonian captivity and to the Assyrian dispersion? Will you serve me only during times of abundance, or will you serve me in famine as well?" Have you ever thought about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? How many times famine happened? There they are, the blessed ones of God, to carry out the very purpose of God, and yet he didn't keep them free from famine, did he? Jacob had to send his boys down to buy grain in Egypt. Abraham flees because of famine. There's a constant terribleness to their experiences, and yet blessing. They have great physical blessings that God has given them, but that didn't take away the toughness of what life can be. "Will you be committed to me only when you have money to pay the mortgage, or will you serve me if you have to sell the house to survive? Will you honor me when your marriage is healthy and your house is full of laughter and joy, or will you serve me when there is divorce and the death of your child?" You see, tests weed us. And that's exactly what God was doing with the manna. What is it? It's a test, first of all. What is it? "Not by bread alone do we live." Again, in his recounting of this in Deuteronomy, the very next verse of what we read a moment ago, Deuteronomy 8, verse 3, "He humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know by that process that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God." You see, I always think about this time of the service, and if everything else has gone over a little bit longer, that I'm the one that has to shorten it, or if we get out a little bit late, all of a sudden folks are thinking, "Man, I'm hungry. When is this guy going to get done?" You know, the reality of that is, that's what we fight all the time. But what we're doing here, God says, is vastly more important. Because our bellies are going to get hungry again. Our souls will be emaciated and stand before him in the day of judgment, void of anything that God can say, "You're well-pleasing," if we have not fed our souls, if we've not believed him and followed him. If we will not serve God in the least of these things, those manna laws kind of seems like, you know, the kind of minutiae, the stuff that you read about in the law of Moses. You think, why did he say all this? Because here's the reason. Why would you obey the 10 if you won't obey the little? Why would you do what God asks you to do when it really gets tough in the 10? How do you honor father and mother when father and mother are reprobates? How do you serve God when maybe your marriage is pulled asunder? Because one will follow God, one doesn't. There are tests like that that come every day into the lives of so many people that follow the Lord. And someday will probably be so with your life if it hasn't been yet. Will we serve God when it really counts, as we would say? One tree in the Garden of Eden that man was forbidden to eat of. One tree. Will you obey me? Luke, the 16th chapter and verse 10, he says, who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And would they follow the man of laws, which they didn't? You read with me already that he told them there wouldn't be any on the day of Sabbath, and they go out looking for it. He told them, don't keep it over till the next day because it's going to breed worms and stink. They kept it over on the days of the week that were not the Sabbath, and it did exactly what God said it would do. And you think about yourself, how can people be like that? Because have you looked around in a church and lived and looked in a mirror yourself and said there are times that you look at people and wonder, are you listening to what God says? Am I listening, most of all, to what God says? What is the manna? What is it? Not by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. What is it? What is it? Is dependence upon a faithful God. Every day they went deeper and deeper into the wilderness, farther from oases, farther away from civilization. He takes them in to a land, as was described later to them, of scorpions, of vipers, farther from the life-giving Nile. There are no stores. You ever think about how easy it is for us to go get stuff? So with Willa's family, and it doesn't matter when you bring a family reunion, if somebody's forgot stuff. Most of the time it's ice. We didn't get enough ice. Or you don't have enough water. And so I was the go fetch person because I'm not really kin to the family, you know. Just married into it. So send them out, you know. Go get the ice. Go get the water. Because right down the street, there are 7 different convenience stores that you can pick the one you want to go to. Or you can go to that automatic thing and fill the ice there. But you're in a wilderness where there are no stores. There's no place to go buy food. Every day the sun becomes hot and the manna melted away. You pillow your head at night, having gathered only, remember, only enough to eat that day, except for the Sabbath. So what will the morrow bring? Leave none of it till morning. There wasn't going to be any more until the next day. And you might have seen the anger of God in Korah and Dathan and Abiram and of Nadab and Abihu and of the golden calf incident and of those that held the censers up in Korah, Dathan, and Abiram that were killed by God. And you would wonder a little bit, wouldn't you, that all it would take is if God didn't let the manna fall the next day. 40 years. He is faithful to them. I want you to think about the faithfulness of God. They were unfaithful to Him. They were constantly, as we'll see in a minute, grumbling, murmuring, complaining, and yet God didn't shut the manna off because they were murmuring and grumbling and complaining. It says the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land of Canaan. There was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Joshua chapter 5 and verse 12. There are crop failures, as we've already said, about the famines in the land of Canaan. There are missed days that you don't have food and are going to buy and eat from the years before, but not with the manna. You think of it daily except for the Sabbath, the manna routine was that they got up and they went out. And God provided for them. Now, yes, this is a miracle, something that would not happen under normal events. A food that can fall, and think about it, folks, a food that provides them all the minerals, the vitamins, the stuff your body needs, God knows. Yeah, they had their herds, they had milk, they had some other things. But for the most part, God is taking care of their bodies by what's in that manna. A food that melts. When the sun comes out. And yet, this miracle-working God, is He any different from the providential God that is ours? The same God. Miracles of manna, is that God different than the God of the field and the garden, of the beehive and the milk cow, of the fattening cattle and the laying chickens? of the olive grove and the vineyard. You see, that same God is as faithful to take care of his people. He has promised us, has he not? As David said in Psalm 37:25, I have been young and now I'm old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. But you think in a modern society how quickly our world can be undone. We've seen some of it, haven't we? We've seen the lack of stuff on the shelves. Have you ever been down in the country where I came from? Hurricanes come and how fast everything disappears on the shelf. How much a gallon of water will cost you now if you don't have some stored up at home? When Katrina and Ike and Harvey came, you think of what a slender thread holds society together. How much can you store up? Are you one of these people that have gone out into the wilderness and we got food to last us for the next 5 years, and they packed everything in? And I dare say none of us here are yet done all of that. How many days can you go without water? How many days can you go without electricity? One of our elders, where I came from, lived out in the country, and he didn't want to have a disruption in his electric supply, so he put in two huge propane tanks to power his generator. I asked him, I said, Steve, how long can you last on that if there was no electricity? He said, I can go 30 days. What do you do on 31? What happens to everything in the freezer? You see, folks, how quickly, and we've watched it in the pandemic, this modern society can unravel. And we're not in the Great Depression days where everybody has gardens. We'd all be over at Brother Johnson's place. Quick. And to Danny and Lana's, whoever else has gardens, we'd be wondering where our next meal is going to come from. Or would we trust God? Well, we know that he's not going to forsake his people. Finally, the manna, what is it? It is grace. The grace of God to a bunch of grumbling ingrates. They didn't deserve it, murmuring, complaining. How many times do you read it in this text? 45 into the days of the wilderness, and they've just forgotten about the awe-inspiring plagues of Egypt. The distant fading memory that they watched all those Egyptians soldiers wash up on the shore, dead at their feet. And God has provided for them water when they needed it. But instead of punishing them, he just keeps giving them the manna every day. Oh, they would say, had we seen the mighty miracles of Exodus, we would have strong faith. They had, and they didn't. You and I sometimes say, oh, if we just had the miracles that happened in the days of Jesus, man, what servants we would be. No, we'd be just like the rich man that begged Abraham, send back Lazarus, that he may tell my brothers not to come to this place. And he said what to him? They have Moses and the prophets. They won't read it. They're not going to believe, even if a mighty miracle is done. He did that experiment in the wilderness, and almost everybody failed. See, the reality is, do we grumble and murmur and complain? He brings us over into the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 10:10-11. Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, these things happened to them as an example. They were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages have come. Anybody grumble during the pandemic? Did we? Did we complain about stuff? Did we grumble about things that are difficult, decisions that have to be made? Sometimes we don't stop and think that we're so capable of being just like those people. To understand what was written in the book of Numbers, chapter 11, verses 4 through 6, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. I never read that passage. I was thinking they must have had bad breath. But now our strength is dried up and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. I get on kicks sometimes. I'm sort of now on a cold cereal kick. That'll run its course and I'll be back on oatmeal. And then that'll run its course and I'll be on eggs in the morning, the sausage. And then that'll run its course, because what happens with most of us? Well, we like to vary things. We like to have all those tastes. I'm a few weeks into eating manna every day. Right at first, you go, wow, there's honey on wafers. Honey, what's for lunch today? Honey on wafers. More manna. What's for supper, dear? More manna. I'm into it now a year. Babe, what's for breakfast this morning? Manna. What's for supper? Manna. You know what happens? It don't take long for me to begin to say, you know, I remember those good foods I used to eat. How did God answer all of this griping and complaining? He just kept on giving them gracious love every day. They gathered an omer. Now, your version, mine says in English Standard, that that's 2 pints. An omer was about, 2 quarts, 4 pints. Another I read said 6, so I operated off of that. If there were 2 million people, they gathered 12 million pints each day, or 9,000 pounds. They gathered 4,500 tons every day. It would take you 300 railroad cars loaded with 15 tons of manna to feed those folks every day. It's based on that 6 omers. An omer being 6 pints. Can you imagine that? That's a quantity of food to feed these people. And God never once shut it off. Not once when they griped or complained or belly ached or said we're not going to follow Him. It was His grace. So what is it for you and me? The grace of God that sent Jesus to die for us. The man in the wilderness could not give life everlasting. Those that ate it still died eventually. But those that eat the living bread, that's why Jesus says this in John 6, I am the bread of life, living bread. Your fathers ate the man in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. And when he got through with that discourse, there were disciples that said, this is a hard saying. They didn't understand what he's talking about, drinking his blood and eating his flesh, and they're not thinking about what he's going to liken this to of his own death in the end. And they turned and walked no more with him. Do you think they're with him? These aren't Pharisees. These aren't the Sadducees. These are disciples. They're with him. But when it got rough and they didn't understand, and they just said, that's it. They turned and walked no more with him. Where are you this morning? Will you walk with him, no matter how tough it is? Will you believe he is the living bread? That's what he declares. Bread that will give life everlasting if we will obey him and follow him. Manna, what is it? It's all of this. All together we stand and sing.